From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. What do you need in order to vote? You have to be at least 18 and a citizen of the United States. You have to be registered. And now, depending on where you live, you may have to show a government ID. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld an Indiana law that requires voters to show a government-issued photo identification before casting a ballot. Supporters say the law will prevent voter fraud. Critics say it will force some poor, rural, and elderly voters out of the election process. For more, we have Sherilyn Ifill, civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland Law School, and Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hi, Farai.
So some folks say that these ID requirements prevent voter fraud. Sherilyn, how much evidence is there of widespread voter fraud?
None. It's a very simple question to answer. And you see it in the opinion. It's one of the most glaring aspects of the opinion. And that is that the state of Indiana was unable to present any evidence of widespread voting fraud, certainly widespread voting fraud as it relates to, you know, showing up on election day and pretending to be somebody that you're not, which is what this photo ID law is purportedly designed to address. In fact, the Supreme Court was only able to identify one instance, not even in the state of Indiana, I think in an election in Washington State, in which it had been documented that such voter fraud had occurred. There are other kinds of voter fraud related to absentee voting and so forth that have been documented, but those are not the kinds of voting fraud that would have been addressed by the photo ID requirement at issue in the Crawford case. There really wasn't any evidence.
Now, I'm going to get to you in a second, Ron, but Sherilyn, it seems most of us use government-issued photo IDs all the time for any number of things in our lives, whether it's showing ID to sign a check at a store, traveling by plane if we do that, you know, driver's licenses. Why is this burdensome if it is? I mean, it sounds on the surface like it wouldn't pose a problem.
This may sound like a stretch, Farai, but I'm going to make the analogy anyway. It's almost like when people ask the question, you know, prior to Hurricane Katrina, why didn't people leave? For those of us who live, you know, fairly organized middle-class lives, these kinds of requirements are not going to be onerous or burdensome. You know, we would have packed up the car, gone to the ATM, gotten some money, and left New Orleans. We will have a photo, a government-issued photo ID. But for people who are poor, for people who are rural individuals, for the elderly, particularly elderly people who were born out of state and therefore don't necessarily have their birth certificate, for people who are leading more disorganized lives because of their socioeconomic condition, these things are burdensome. And what the Supreme Court showed in their opinion is something I think we're seeing consistently with this court, which is a real inability to relate to the lives, the way people live at the margins rather than at the center.
Ron, how do you parse out the court's decision and, you know, vis-a-vis people who may not have a lot of opportunity?
Wow, Farai, just listening to the professor's comments there, I have so much to say. I don't know where to begin. I think it's one of the most sacred privileges, not a right, but a privilege to be able to exercise the right to vote in the United States of America. The question that was presented to the Supreme Court was whether or not this was an overly burdensome or an onerous provision requiring individuals to come out with a government-issued identification card in order to vote. One of the important things in looking at the opinion, of course, is the fact that it is very, very interesting to note that one of the arguments that was presented was, well, you know, this is going to keep people of lower income, socioeconomic status away, and they're not going to be able to afford a government ID card. Well, the state of Indiana said that if you're not of social means to be able to afford it, we'll provide it for you. Well, it's going to be confusing for people who might be elderly, or it might lead to disenfranchisement. I think that's ridiculous. One of the things that's important to keep in mind also is the fact that to enter a government building, you have to show an ID, as you pointed out, to go to the airport, to function in American society. Most individuals have a government-issued ID. And again, the question is presented is whether or not that is an overly onerous or burdensome requirement, and 6-3. And John Paul Stevens, a very, very stalwart liberal lion, if you will, wrote the majority opinion, not someone who I would say is necessarily out of touch with American society. So to suggest that a 6-3 decision by the Supreme Court denotes that they're out of touch on this very minor provision, I think, is very, very misleading. And it's a privilege to vote in this country. And if the state of Indiana wants to have that requirement, there's no problem as long as you can prove that it's not overly burdensome.
Farai, let me just correct two things. One, One is it's a right to vote in the United States.
No, it is a privilege to vote. You can have that. You can have that right taken away if you're incarcerated. It's a privilege to vote.
All right, guys.
The right to vote can be burdened when the state can show that it has a justification, a rational justification, a legitimate justification, and many would suggest a compelling justification to burden that right. That's why we've eliminated things, and the Supreme Court's eliminated things like the poll tax. Because the first question we ask is, does the state have a justification? And therefore, the first question that should be asked is the question that Farai asked first, and that is, what is the justification? What is the evidence of widespread voter fraud? And there isn't any. And it seems to me that's the focus of the case. And once you answered the question, no, the state does not have a sufficient justification to burden the right, then there's no need to go any further into the questions that you're answering. And I think I already, you know, suggested that, again, if we're talking about, you know, average middle-class people who actually go to airports and enter government buildings to go to meetings, then of course they have a driver's
license. Let me get Ron back in here.
We're talking about.
Ron, is there a chance? I mean, we are practically on the eve of the Indiana Democratic primary. Do you think there's a chance that this decision will affect people who, you know, again, people who may be rural and elderly, who may not have heard about the Supreme Court decision? Is this all of a sudden going to affect people who are going to show up and try to vote in that primary?
No, because it's my understanding that those individuals who will go to the polls next Tuesday for this pivotal election, if they don't have that identification card, they can still vote and have a provisional ballot cast and then have an opportunity later to produce that government ID. So to suggest that people are going to be held away from the polls or not able to vote, I think is specious on its face. And let me say something else, Farai, as it pertains to the Supreme Court case. The Chief Justice of the United States signed a concurrence opinion that suggested that if, in fact, there was evidence that there was a burden, or if there was evidence that it would be overly restrictive, then the Supreme Court could adopt their most severe level of scrutiny, which is called strict scrutiny, which determines whether or not there's a compelling government interest to get involved. So to suggest that, well, this case is going to be somehow akin to the poll tax or it's going to keep people away, the Chief Justice left open the very real possibility that if, in fact, someone can return to the Supreme Court and prove that there is evidence that people are being held away from the polls or not being able to exercise the right to vote, then the Supreme Court could address that through strict scrutiny later. So again, this is a very narrow case. If there is evidence that it's keeping people away, the Supreme Court, in a concurring opinion, has already said how they would particularly deal with that situation.
Sherilyn, and I'm going to ask this both of you, what does this say about voting rights in America on a broader sense in terms of what the burden is on citizens to take responsibility for, you know, hitting certain benchmarks in order to vote? Is there a tightening, a general tightening of restrictions?
Oh, I think that if you read the three-justice dissent and actually also read it with the majority opinion or the three-justice plurality opinion, that I wonder how the Supreme Court would respond to the Harper versus Virginia Board of Elections poll tax case that was decided decades ago. I really wonder whether they would have struck down the poll tax. And I think we haven't, you know, touched on the great unsaid in this case, which is the partisan nature of this imposition on the right to vote. And there's no question that this whole illusion of voter fraud is something that's been pushed by Republicans in a number of jurisdictions and in a number of ways. And this is one of them. And the Supreme Court really does not address and seems unwilling to confront the ways in which there is this partisan manipulation of the right to vote. And until the Supreme Court's ready to take that on in an open and honest way, I think we're going to see more additional laws like the one in Indiana imposed to take advantage of what people think will be the partisan returns from discouraging certain segments of the population to vote.
This has nothing to do with partisan political politics or evil doing at play here. This has a very narrow application with the state of Indiana looking to determine whether or not it was overly restrictive or burdensome for people to produce a government identification. When you suggest that a 6-3 opinion authored by John Paul Stevens, one of the most liberal and one of the longest serving members of the Supreme Court, is A, out of touch, or B, somehow willing to roll back the rights of individual to exercise the right to vote, I think is not an accurate characterization. I am very, very concerned about the integrity of the ballot system, the election system, and if municipalities and states around the United States wish to ensure the integrity of the ballot system and the Supreme Court finds that legal, that should be the end of the discussion.
Before I let you guys wrap this up, looking ahead, do you think that this is going to have any impact on the general election? You seemed, Ron, to hint that there should be a great scrutiny of voting security. What do you think the impact of this will be on the general election, if any?
I think minimal. I don't see this playing out of disenfranchising or removing people's will or inclination or desire to vote because of what happened in Indiana. I think you're going to have a record turnout in this election, and in this case will not have any impact in minimizing that. I look forward to November.
Sherilyn?
Well, I think in Indiana, for those people who don't have that government-issued ID and for which it would be a burden to try and get one prior to the election, those people are likely not to vote. Ron mentioned the fact that you can vote with a provisional ballot, but then you have to, within 10 days of the election, show up at the circuit court to verify that you're the person who voted. And if we're talking about elderly people, if we're talking about people who live in rural communities, people who lack transportation, in the 21 counties in which there's not public transportation in the state of Indiana, then I think they are unlikely to vote.
Well, Sherilyn and Ron, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Sherilyn Ifill is a civil rights lawyer and law professor at the University of Maryland School of Law, and Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. He joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. One out of every three black boys born today can expect to spend time in a state or federal prison at some point in their life. That staggering statistic comes from the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit focused on criminal justice policy. But those numbers are just a hint of America's incarceration crisis. This nation locks up more people as a percentage of population and in raw numbers overall than any other place in the world. Today we launch a month-long series on criminal justice. Today we break down the numbers, who's committing crimes, who gets caught and why, and what are reformers doing to make sure the justice system is, in fact, just. In a few minutes we'll hear from the Iowa Governor Chet Culver. He recently signed a law that tries to make sure new legislation doesn't increase racial disparities in his state's criminal justice system. But first we'll talk to Ryan King. He's a policy analyst for the Sentencing Project. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Farai.
So can you break down some of the numbers about incarceration by race, ethnicity, and gender?
Sure. Let's take a look, first of all, at the overall numbers. There's about 2.3 million Americans that are in prison or jail in the U.S. That comes out to about 1 in 133. But when you start looking at probation and parole on top of that, about more than 7 million Americans at this point, you're talking about 1 in 31 Americans that are under some type of correctional supervision. But to really understand criminal justice, you need to get into the issues of racial disparity. And 40% of those persons in prison are African-American. You mentioned earlier, 1 in 3 African-American males born today will spend some time in their life in prison or jail, which I think is a particularly stunning number. And when you look at young black males under correctional supervision, that's black males in their 20s, 1 in 3 right now are currently under correctional supervision, and 1 in 6 black males in the entire U.S. has spent some time in their life in prison. So these are really stunning numbers. These aren't sort of people at the margins, but really a significant portion of an entire population of this country.
Is this just because young black men commit more crime? I mean, is this one of those things where, you know, it's not a disparity?
No, it's very much a disparity, and we have mountains and mountains of research on this. I think particularly you need to look at the war on drugs. It's been the biggest contributor to the rise in incarceration going back to 1980 or so. And we know that the war on drugs is defined by its discretion. And the fact of the matter is African Americans who are disproportionately arrested and incarcerated for drug offenses are not that those numbers are not representative of their overall use. So 12% of the general population in the U.S. is African-American. About 12% of regular drug users, monthly drug users, are African-American, but about three times that rate are arrested and about four times that rate are incarcerated. We know that the primary means of drug sales are intra-racial, so it tends to be African-American to African-American, white to white. So what's going on with these arrest and conviction numbers has a lot more to do with the decisions and discretion of where we choose to pursue the war on drugs than in who's using drugs and who's selling drugs.
Let's add socioeconomics into the mix? Because in some cases there are the drug sales, for example, that are across race, where you have people, you know, I used to live in New York City, and folks would always talk about the folks driving in from New Jersey and then picking up their drugs in, you know, New York City and then driving back. And a lot of the dealers would be black and brown. A lot of the customers would be white. How does something like that affect these overall statistics?
Well, the fact is that tends to be the proverbial story that you hear. And I'm not arguing with the fact that there is interracial drug sales. But by and large, we know that there tends to be primarily intra-racial drug sales. But here's another key fact, and why I think we also see higher rates of arrest among African Americans, is that from really good ethnographic research that's been done, suggests that African Americans' drug markets tend to be more stranger to stranger, and they tend to take place in public areas. I think this is really key. White drug markets tend to rely more upon referrals from friends or colleagues, coworkers, and they tend to take place in private, as does drug use. So one of the very practical implications of this is that it's much more easy to detect and pursue the war on drugs in African-American communities. And in fact, some of the historical research looking back at the war on drugs, particularly the crack cocaine market in the 1980s, suggests that the very public nature of it, the fact that here in Washington, D.C., open-air drug markets were widely available and widely visible within blocks of the U.S. Capitol, really raised the issue to a national profile.
When you look at race in the criminal justice system, there's also the question of victim and offender. And I know that there are some statistics about how much more likely the sentences are to be heavy for African Americans, for example, who murder whites, as opposed to African Americans who murder other African Americans. How else, you know, whether it's in the case of something like that, but how else does race kind of play into who gets sentenced for how long, under what circumstances?
Well, it's important to go all the way back to the very beginning. We're talking about arrest here, where the war on drugs is pursued, where police tend to be in higher concentrations, or there are going to be higher arrest rates. And our sentencing system functions very much on criminal history. It functions very much on habitual offender laws. And so if you're African American, just by virtue of geographic segregation that is very commonplace in the U.S., you have a higher likelihood of having police contact, higher likelihood of being arrested, higher likelihood of that arrest leading to a booking, charge, conviction, sentence, etc. It goes on. And then the cumulative effect of just being African American puts an individual at a disadvantage versus being white in the criminal justice system. And so when the sentencing system is based upon your criminal history, it's based upon all of these different factors, it's very difficult to identify, well, it's the police, well, it's the courts, well, it's corrections. That's where the racial disparity exists. It exists all along the way, in some cases very explicit ways, in some cases very subtle ways, that disadvantage African Americans. And the cumulative effect is what we see in the incarceration population.
There are plenty of black folks who will say black folks need to get it together. You know, especially with black on black crime, we just need to get it together within our community. Other folks will point to the system. Other people will look at a combination. From your perspective, doing what you do with the Sentencing Project, what needs to happen now?
Well, this is we could make all of the reforms that the Sentencing Project advocates tomorrow morning. And in many cases, we still would have not addressed a lot of the underlying reasons that crime occurs. The criminal justice system doesn't exist in a vacuum. The fact that we see these incarceration numbers, these arrest numbers that we're discussing, are a reflection of failures, in my opinion, in terms of addressing poverty, economic opportunity, education, healthcare. In many of these communities where there are very high density incarceration, high density arrest rates, there are also all of these failures to provide social services to this community. So many times you'll see members of African American communities, they'll throw their arms up and say, enough's enough, lock these people away. I don't want these people on my streets, and it's a public safety issue, and you have to be sympathetic to that, but you also need to take a step back and take a look at why crime occurs in certain places, why is there drug selling in certain neighborhoods, why are the police in certain neighborhoods, and what failures have occurred all along the continuum that result in what we see in these incarceration numbers.
Finally, and briefly, give us an example of something that you've heard about that you think works.
Well, I think, for instance, looking at addressing sentencing through racial ethnic impact statements, which the Governor Culver from Iowa is going to discuss next, has been critical. This conversation we're having about racial disparity should be something that we don't have after the fact. We talk about crack cocaine. We shouldn't be talking about that 20 years later. We should be talking about it before the fact. We can predict, we can forecast what these impacts are. So let's get these conversations up front in legislature so that legislators, when they have an opportunity to address these things, can do it up front before the law is passed.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ryan King is a policy analyst for the Sentencing Project, a nonprofit criminal justice policy group, and he was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. Less than a year ago, a national report by the Sentencing Project found Iowa has the highest rate of racial disparity among inmates of any state. Currently, 2% of Iowa's population is black, while 24% of its prison population is black. Just last month, Iowa became the first state to pass legislation that would require state officials to examine the racial and ethnic impact of new criminal justice policies. States including Connecticut and Illinois are considering similar laws. Joining me now is Iowa's Governor Chet Culver. Thanks for coming on.
It's my pleasure. Good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Were you surprised by the findings that your state had this racial disparity in sentencing?
Absolutely. This is a distinction that we don't want in terms of being first in the nation in the ratio of African Americans in prison. And it's my goal as the new governor to take this head on and address it, and we have taken a number of important steps to trying to figure out the root cause, and as long as I'm governor, we will continue to make that a high priority.
Why is it important for you to put this issue front and center?
Well, historically, Iowa has actually been a leader on the issue of civil rights. In fact, we were one of the very first states to assure African Americans the right to vote. So we, despite this distinction that we have right now, historically we've been very progressive, and it's my hope that we can address this challenge and get back to leading the way in terms of opportunity and fairness and equality for all of our citizens.
What are you seeing in Iowa in terms of patterns within this pattern? Meaning, are there certain crimes that are more likely to show evidence of disparity between who's convicted than others? What are the hot spots for you within this issue that you're addressing?
Very generally speaking, you've got to look at everything from the courtrooms, the sentencing guidelines, to the classification in terms of where these individuals go once they enter the correction system. We're working on things at the back end in terms of preparing Iowans as they re-enter society. You know, one of the obvious challenges that I think we can address right now is that we have, on a given day in Iowa, 300 to 400 prisoners that have done their time, but we have difficulties placing them and finding employment opportunities and housing arrangements. So they're literally stuck, in some cases, in the system when they should be out. And that's an area where I am trying to move very, very aggressively to figure out how we can break that logjam. I mean, that's a very obvious place to start.
I want to ask a little bit more about the minority impact statement that you mentioned this new law has. Now, this law doesn't apply to statutes that are already on the books, but ones that are going to be considered or implemented in the future. Is that correct?
That is correct. It means that when members of the General Assembly in Iowa and executive branch are considering legislation in the future, they will be able to have a much better understanding of the potential effects, both positive and negative, on Iowa's minority communities. For example, if you have a law that requires a certain sentence for a certain type of crime, we want to know roughly what impact that will have on minority communities throughout the state. What impact will it have on our criminal justice system or the Department of Corrections? How many people perhaps could go to jail as a result, and for how long? Because we've all learn that, you know, building prisons is not the answer. It's got to be a more comprehensive approach. And I think I was proud of the fact that despite some areas where we have a lot of work to do, this is a huge step forward in terms of good public policy that will help us, I think, a great deal in the future.
What about people who say, look, if you did the crime, you do the time, no matter what, no matter who, why is this kind of a bill even on the table, or why was this kind of law passed, rather?
I think people still do believe that if you commit a crime and break the laws in this state, there will be consequences. But I think it's just a smart kind of common sense approach that will more likely than not help us govern more effectively and make us pause and think about the impact that certain types of legislation might have on minority communities across our state. And I think given the fact that we are leading the nation in terms of having 24% of Iowa's prison population consisting of African Americans, with just 2% of Iowa's general public being African American, suggests we need to do something a little bit differently. And I think this bill will help us, as I say, in the future.
You come from a political legacy. Your father represented Iowa in the House of Representatives and then in the U.S. Senate. And having seen what you have of government, what would you like to see the federal government do, if anything, to try to insert itself into this whole question of racial disparities in the prison population?
Perhaps we can partner with Congress to encourage them to take some steps like the one that we've taken here at the federal level. Number two, I think it's really about equality and fairness and not being afraid to acknowledge that there are problems and there are challenges, and having the political courage, whether it's here at the State House in Iowa or in Washington, D.C., to admit that we've got some real discrepancies out there, and they're not going to change unless we are willing to admit that we've got some problems. Perhaps the next president can provide us with some real leadership on this issue, and I know that Iowa lawmakers stand ready to partner with the next president or Congress to figure out how we can work together to address these same concerns that we have in Iowa and across the nation. Let me just add that, you know, I think the bottom line here, the other way we're addressing this issue is through education. We are focusing on becoming the first state in the nation to offer universal preschool to every four-year-old. We're on our way to doing that. We're also taking some very aggressive steps in terms of health care, and we hope to be the first state in the nation to cover every child in terms of health care. So there are quality of life steps that we believe we can take that will long-term also reduce the number of all Iowans of all different races that are incarcerated. I really believe that as a former government teacher and coach, that education and health care are the great equalizers in terms of helping people achieve their hopes and dreams.
Well, Governor, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Iowa Governor Chet Culver, he recently signed into law a bill that will require lawmakers to look at the impact that new sentencing laws could have on racial and ethnic groups. The new requirement applies to crime, parole, and probation issues, and Iowa is the first state in the country to have such a law. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time for sports with NPR's Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
So let me guess, it's playoff time in the NBA, and it is getting rough on the court.
Boy, you got that right. You know, fans expect it to get rough in the playoffs, but this is something new. The Boston Celtics and the Atlanta Hawks, the Cleveland Cavaliers and Washington Wizards have been woofing at each other, throwing elbows, committing flagrant fouls, and even throwing up, listen to this, what some are calling gang signs. Here to talk more about it is New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill.
The great Tony Cox. How are you doing this
morning? I'm doing great, man. You know, that Boston series has been particularly contentious, with Kevin Garnett involved in a questionable skirmish and teammate Paul Pierce being fined $25,000 for that menacing hand gesture, which he says was not a gang sign. What in the world is going on?
Tony, playoff time. That's why the NBA playoffs, I think, are probably the greatest playoffs in all pro sports. You know, by the time you're at that fifth game, you hate each other. You know what people have been eating for breakfast, and it's getting really rough and ready. And you know, Paul Pierce, I mean, gang signs. I mean, the kind of money this guy's making, I think the only gang sign he's seen is something he's seen on television. But
You know, he's from Inglewood, you know, and I'm sure he knows what the gang sign looks like, whether or not he was throwing it up or not. But what do you think?
Television.
It's just weird. Wasn't that just bizarre?
It was a little bizarre. But, I mean, I just think that these playoffs, all of them, Boston, Atlanta, you know, Atlanta took him to school down in Atlanta, just gave him no respect. And as brutal as that series is, Tony, when you go over to the Washington Cavaliers series, that's even rougher because
Before you go to that one, I have another question about Boston, and then we'll go to Washington next, and that's this, because some are saying that Commissioner David Stern has a double standard. You know, Garnett not fined or suspended for his altercation. Neither were two players who left the bench during that altercation. Now, that's unlike last year when two Phoenix players were suspended for the very same thing against San Antonio, weren't they?
Yeah, and yes, exactly. And I think that's exactly – this is the commissioner's equivalent of the makeup call. Because he took so much heat, the NBA took so much heat from what happened last year in Phoenix when their key players were suspended before a critical game. And I think that you look at this, and the bottom line is that people want to see the stars play. You know, people don't want to see Kevin Garnett in street clothes. And so I think that something short of some egregious yoking, you're not going to see what you saw last year because, frankly, this is a star league. It's a league of makeup calls, and you're just not gonna. And I agree with it. I don't think that you need to throw out players in playoffs unless it's really, really, really something.
Something egregious.
Very,
right?
Very egregious, very flagrant. Right. I don't think that rose to that level.
Let's talk about Washington and Cleveland since you brought it up. Deshaun Stevenson, Brendan Haywood have been really rough on LeBron James. Stevenson was fined 25,000 big ones for making a throat-slashing gesture with his finger. Here's two questions for you, Bill Roden. Are these dirty plays, or are these guys just doing their jobs and LeBron James is being protected because he's a superstar?
Well, to answer your first thing, they're doing their job at playoff time. And rather than be protected, Tony, I mean, LeBron is getting no respect. I mean, he's not getting the Jordan treatment. The players are talking trash. They're hitting him. They're really beating him up. And the officials aren't really protecting him a lot. I mean, not like they would protect Michael. And I think that
But he's not Michael yet.
He's not. Oh, and that's why he's not being protected like Michael. You know, he's got about six championships to go yet. And, you know, and I think that, you know, and to an extent, I don't want to see anybody get hurt, Tony. Mm-hmm. But I really like this. I like the idea because we're in such a culture where people are rewarded before they even do anything. I think it's cool that everybody from the players, they say, listen, LeBron, the hype is fine, but we're going to make a distinction between the commercial hype and how you earn it on the court. And right now, LeBron has not, particularly if you use Michael Jordan and Magic and those guys and Bird as a standard, he hasn't earned it yet.
He hasn't earned it. All right, let's talk about somebody who did earn something that some people feel, I think you're one of them, that he should have earned a long time ago. We're going to talk about coaching because while NBA coaches who lose are getting fired, Avery Johnson got the axe in Dallas this week, Byron Scott of the New Orleans Hornets got his first ever Coach of the Year honor. What about that?
Yeah, so well-deserved. You know, Byron is always one of those people. You know, some people do a little and get a lot of credit. You know, you may work with some of them. Some people do a lot and never get recognized. And Byron was always, you know, when he was a player, he played with those great Laker teams with Magic and Kareem and Worthy. And he was a pivotal part. He came to New Jersey. There was Jason Kidd. Led a New Jersey franchise to two consecutive NBA Finals.
Two,
and
that's
then,
right, he did.
And then, yeah, and then was fired the next, you know, he was fired the next day, or the next year, when Jason Kidd, of all people, led an insurrection. So that makes this particularly delicious, because not only does he finally get the Coach of the Year award, everybody realizes, but also he gets he kind of gets it on the back of Jason Kidd, you know.
Yeah, that's true. He does.
Listen, it's wonderful. It's really wonderful.
Our time is running short, but I want to mention one other thing before we get out of here, talking about coaches. Here comes Larry Brown again, this time in Charlotte, where the Bobcats haven't done so well under the leadership of owner Bob Johnson and team prez Michael Johnson. What's up, Michael Jordan? What's up there?
Well, you know, you look at Bob and BET, and I think, you know, he likes sports, but I think he bought this franchise as a business investment, as he does with everything. And the only thing about this, you got to win, you know, and you can complain about not getting support and that kind of stuff, but you have to win. You know, people aren't going to just come because, you know, oh, this is a minority owner and we're going to come, and that's not the way it works. You got to spend money, and you got to win. And they have not done either yet. So, well, you know, you have to win, Bob.
We'll have to wait and see whether the great Michael Jordan can finally bring some winning ways to Charlotte. As always, Bill Roden, it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Hey, Tony, it's always a pleasure. It's mine.
We'll talk again.
Take care.
That was NPR's Tony Cox joining me here at NPR West and New York Times sports columnist William C. Roden. Roden is also the author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback, and he joined us at our studios in New York. The Beijing Summer Olympics kick off in about 4 months. This time around, as folks gear up to compete for the gold, they're also dealing with political tensions and questions about air pollution and how it will affect their ability to compete. Jeanette Bolden is coach of the U.S. women's track team. She was an Olympic gold medal winner in the 1984 Summer Games, and she also has asthma. Jeanette, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
I'm great. So what excites you? I mean, it's a huge accomplishment to coach this team. And what excites you about this year's Olympic Games?
We have a fantastic team. You know, naturally, the team isn't picked yet. Everyone will go to the Olympic trials. But whoever comes out in the top three, they will represent this country to the highest degree. I'm sure it will be a balance of our veterans and our up-and-coming athletes. And they did very well last year in the World Championship, and I'm looking forward to seeing the USA do very well in Beijing.
What does it take? You're an Olympian, a medal-winning Olympian. What does it take to have not just the skill but the heart to get a medal in the Olympics?
You know, it takes a lot of sacrifice. You know, many times the athletes have, they've done a lot of competition, of course, from age group track and field through high school. And if they attended college, it takes a lot of dedication, a lot of sacrifice, and a lot of focus. You know, a lot of times, you know, sometimes they can get distracted. But the ones that you see, the cream of the crop that you see at the Olympic Games are extremely focused and dedicated athletes.
What do you think is going to, I mean, I know you can't say who you think the favorites are, but where are we in the process right now? If you take a look at where people are in the Olympic trials process, how much longer is that going to take in terms of people qualifying?
Well, the Olympic trials start toward the end of June and goes until the first part of July. And I think that more than anything, the U.S. did very well for the U.S. versus the world this weekend in that pin relays, and they had a great showing. The U.S. Women won the 4x100-meter relay and the 4x4. The U.S. men won the 4x4. They had a little trouble with the baton exchange in the 4x1, but I'm looking forward to a great, you know, competition this summer, and so far the athletes look very good.
You've had to face asthma as, I guess, an extra competitive question for yourself. You're now running a foundation, the Jeanette Bolden Asthma and Allergy Track Clinic, and you're a member of the board of directors for the Asthma and Allergy Foundation. But before that, you had to deal with this as an athlete. What was your routine? How did you deal separately from some of the other team members with facing asthma as part of being an athlete?
One of the things is that I think asthma has made me even more focused as an athlete. And a lot of times people don't put together having asthma and running track. But my mother pushed me a lot, and my father was, you know, he was the one wanted his baby girl to sit down and not have any problems. And there was a tug of war in my household. But one thing my mother always instilled in me was that asthma isn't a handicap. You can achieve your goals. And she just, you know, I had a tremendous amount of drive and determination. And some of the things I had to do was, you know, I was allergic to, you know, dust, mold, mildew, pet dander. I would travel a lot of times with a pillow because a lot of times in hotels they have feather pillows and down comforters. And I didn't know I was allergic to that until I went to a track meet and I would wake up with asthma. Unfortunately, I think I've gotten to the point now that my asthma is definitely under control.
It sounds strange in a way for someone who has asthma to do track and field at all, because it's such a, you know, you have to have a lot of lung capacity to be able to do those, whether they're sprints or long distance runs. Did you ever think to yourself, you know what, maybe this is just not the right thing for me?
That's funny you mentioned that. When I was younger, my asthma was kind of out of control. I'm from Compton, California, and I was taken out of my home in Compton and placed in an asthmatic home. And there I really started learning that asthma wasn't a handicap. And one thing they taught all the kids there at the home was that you need to get involved in physical activity to feel good about yourself. And we started getting involved in swimming. And from there, I went and got involved in track and field. And like you said, they don't equate the two together. But for me, asthma has made me more determined as an athlete.
Well, Jeanette, thanks so much.
Thank you very, very much.
That was Jeanette Bolden. She is a 1984 Olympic gold medalist and the current coach of the U.S. Olympic women's track and field team. And now time for our letters. Joining me to sift through the mail is editor Sasha Woodruff. Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Fry. How are you?
I am doing great. So what are listeners talking about this week?
Well, we got a couple of letters about a segment we did on Tuesday about the history of white slavery in the United States. Lee Hicks in South Carolina loved the interview we did with one of the authors of the new book, White Cargo. Here's what she wrote. Thank you so much for the discussion of white slavery. I tell people that some of my ancestors were indentured servants, and they laugh at me. They think because I have blue eyes, red hair, and white skin, I couldn't have ancestors who lived as slaves. My great-great-greats were Irish and looked a lot like me.
But not all of our listeners were applauding that segment. Mae Gentry in Atlanta, Georgia, took issue when we used the word slave to refer to white people. She wrote us about some of her ancestors, including an indentured servant who was shipped here from England. May writes, after her indenture term was completed, she married the first mate of the ship on which she had sailed to these shores. Together they owned a 133-acre plantation and black slaves. They also enjoyed the privilege of being white. I have African ancestors as well, who received nothing for their decades of forced labor, who were not free to marry or acquire property, and whose children were born into slavery. NPR, I expect better. May, thank you for sharing your family history. We did discuss the reasons that slavery in America evolved into specifically enslaving Africans and their descendants. But we also talked about the ways that during the era of indentured servitude, white children were taken from one land to another, forced to work, and died en masse before ever having a chance at freedom. The authors of White Cargo write, "Slavery is not defined by time but by the experience of its subject." Whether you agree with their statement is, of course, for you to decide.
Last week, one of our listeners complained that the show focused too much on black issues. Here's how you responded.
Our mission is, and I'm quoting here because we have it up on a big poster board, to illuminate the diversity of the African-American experience. As we do that, we hope to shine light on other folks' experiences as well. But the bottom line is, this is Black News and Notes. But everyone's welcome to listen.
Black people. Well, that response got a lot of responses this week, including one from listener John Watson Jr. in Albany, Georgia. I'm a black listener who feels just as the white collar. On the webpage, the word black is not in the official title. NPR is universal, not segregated. If News and Notes really wants to help blacks, then do as Bill Cosby and shift the attention of blacks to our real failures, which is us, not the U.S.
But Devin Stokesbury in Cincinnati, Ohio, had a different take on the issue. Thanks for sticking to your mission, illuminating the diversity of the African-American experience. It's one radio show, 1 hour out of 24 hours of programming, 1 hour focused on stories about the over 30 million people that are African-American.
And that's it for News and Notes letters this week, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem. See you next week.
That's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. What should you do when you're stopped by the police? Tomorrow we talk to experts, including a police officer, about how to protect your rights.